tonight. Welcome to the newest episode of the Little House Book Club. The Little House Book Club is family-friendly and listener-supported, which means no commercials. If you would like to share your thoughts or suggest a book or author, please email me at mark@walnutgrovecast.com. Today we have a very special guest. She's an author with a passion for history as well as architecture. Like many of us, she discovered Laura Ingalls Wilder in the third grade when she chose On the Banks of Plum Creek from the library. Her book, The Beautiful Snow, discusses the Ingalls family, the railroads, and the hard winter of 1880 and 1881. Please welcome to the show, Cindy Wilson. How are you doing, Cindy?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, this is a book that it seems to me has taken on a life of its own because you're doing a lot of things that I personally really appreciate. And that's you're sharing a lot of the research that went into the book directly. Like you're posting in your Facebook group, if you just do a search for The Beautiful Snow, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. You put these articles because it's wonderful that the internet has created this archive database where we can finally search, unless you're using microfiche, we can finally search historical archives of newspapers from 150 years ago. But so that's something I really enjoy about your group. And I see all the work that you put into this book, which is just really just an interesting work. But anyway, that's enough me talking.
Well, and the Facebook group in process we've been doing, we started in, well, the Facebook group went up before the book came out right. In February of 2020. But this fall, somebody noted that the calendar for 2021-2022 is exactly the same as 1880 to 81. So,
oh, wow.
Thursday, March 30th in 2022 was also a Thursday, March 30th in 1881. Or however it is, what day is it today? The 31st. But anyway, the days line up exactly the same. And so somebody said, hey, can you publish the articles as they came out? So it was sort of like the concept was, okay, you're a new resident of these little towns behind the blockades. And let's imagine that the mail and the newspapers can actually get through. So you're opening your newspaper that day and reading these articles as I'm posting.
Right.
And so you're kind of experiencing the winter as it unfolded week by week. Not entirely, because I'm not putting everything out there. I'm trying to just select a few nuggets from each one. But Thursdays were a really big publication day. Many of the newspapers chose to publish on Thursdays. And so Thursdays are the big day on the Facebook group, too, where it was just hard to whittle down because they may be on the same topic, but have different nuggets. So sometimes there's up to 24 articles that I might publish on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. And then there are days where like no newspapers published on a Sunday. So that gives me the opportunity to share something else related to the hard winter, whether it be videos of plows going through snow. And these videos might be fairly modern, mm-hmm. But people always enjoy seeing a train plow blowing through a big snow bank just to give you the sensation of what it might have been like.
Well, they still do it in a very similar way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those wedge plows are still the main technology for most track areas. They'll use rotaries up in the mountains, but down here on the flatlands, it's still the wedge plows. The thing pushing it has more power, but the plow is the plow.
Now, one of the things that, there's a culture of people who really are into trains, you know, and foamers.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, you know, the foamers.
The foamers,
are you a foamer now? Has this research turned you into a foamer?
I'm not quite a foamer. I may be still in the percolating, bubbling stage.
Sure.
and a lot of the foamers are more, and we shouldn't use that term, but they're more, there's a lot of different niches within the railroad community. And some are more interested in like the colors that the locomotives may have been painted at a certain time. There are people who are just hardcore diesel people, and anything prior to diesels, they have no interest in. I have fallen in love with the whole steam engine thing. Before I started doing this research, I had no interest in railroads. They were just something that would interrupt my biking and I'd fall down, or I've rollerbladed into a, you know, a train crossing and fallen down. So railroad tracks to me before I did this research were this annoyance thing.
Sure.
And once I started doing the research and really got into the history and the true transformation of history and society that the trains kind of brought forth, I became fascinated. And so now I am actually seeking out train museums, and I have eaten at converted roundhouses. Yeah. And there's this whole, and I have a proclivity towards going deep, deep, deep down into rabbit holes. And so I'm trying to not make too much eye contact with the whole train thing. Mm-hmm. But I am speaking soon at the annual Chicago and Northwestern Historical Society meetup.
Oh, that's great.
I am terrifically excited about that. And we'll see where it all leads. But you know, there's a danger.
I talk about Lancaster, Pennsylvania a lot because we tend to go there a couple times a year. And they have, I believe it's the Strasburg Railroad Museum. And it's a huge museum. You know, they have full trains and the whole history of, because, you know, of course, Pennsylvania being a big part of train history, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they even have, I think it's called the Red Caboose, where you can go and book a caboose and that's your hotel room. Like, it's just a bunch of them and it's kind of relatively cheap. And we've never stayed at it, but we drive by and it's like, hey, you know, I wonder if that would be fun. It's like, let's just go to the regular hotel. But it does look like one of these kind of really fun type of things. I'm going to put a link to those things in the show notes. But if you're ever in Pennsylvania, it's really just a huge train museum. So it's definitely worth checking out.
And that's Lancaster. I've always wanted to go there anyway.
Yeah, Lancaster is a great place. It's such a fun place to go to. And, you know, of course, with our love of 19th century things and the Amish, it kind of meshes and, you know, you just see a lot of real crafted stuff and things you don't normally see outside. Yep.
And I'm a quilter as well. So that's been on my list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're big into quilts. You got to go there and put on the white gloves before you go even look at them.
Yep.
But, quilting is one of those huge things that I think is finding a new, it's like new to the to today's world. Do you think that maybe it had to do with being at home? Like, with basically being stuck at home, you know, with the pandemic and everything, you know, did you quilt before the pandemic?
Oh, yeah. I started quilting about the time my daughter was born, about 33 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I joined into a very prolific community of quilters. So I don't know that it's so much new as visibility is new. Mm-hmm. Because the community I've belonged to has been going strong for many decades. And the level of shows and the number of major quilt shows that have gone on, I don't know if they even... sorry, I'm losing my train of thought.
No, it's fine.
I think it's been a very healthy community. It's had some ebbs and flows, but there's a large number of major quilt shows every year. I mean, the kind that fill major venues for a week and are filled to the gills with vendors and
that's what the Amish do.
Quilts on display.
The Amish have entire auctions. Well, they have farm auctions, but then they'll have an entire corner that's dedicated to just quilts. And some very expensive ones as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And another thing, I mean, while we're on the topic of, you know, me saying that it's possible that that the pandemic maybe brought people to quilt, maybe one person out there. But you took that time to learn an instrument. So if you could talk a little bit about that. You learned to play the cello.
I did. I'm still a student. My 2-year anniversary with my teacher is coming up soon. I had always wanted to play the cello, and one day I was scrolling through Facebook and a video, one of those suggested for you videos, popped up of a very amazing cellist playing the Swan. Mm. And it's a beautiful piece of music, and she made it so beautiful. And I simply shared it and said, you know, one of my regrets is that I never learned to play the cello. And one of my girlfriends, who is a cello player, simply put as a reply, it's never too late to learn. And then she may have even added, remember, Laura Ingalls Wilder didn't begin her novels until she was in her 60s. Of course, she'd been writing before that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of made me realize, well, I suppose you could try and teach an old dog some new tricks. And here we are. I ordered a student level cello, and
cello is a great instrument. I play a few instruments. I cannot play the cello. My son played cello for a little while, but he just moved on from it. But I've attempted, and I play guitar and piano. So it's like I understand like the notes, but cello, I don't know. There's something different about it. I really love it though.
There's a lot of moving parts in a stringed instrument. I'd played clarinet for like 40 years, so I already knew music, but that was treble clef. The cello is bass clef. Sure. And then with the stringed instrument, you have not only the fingerings you're doing with your left hand, you've got how you're holding your bow, how you're moving the bow.
Keep it in tune.
Oh my God. You know, all that, you know, especially spring and fall when the air changes, it's so many moving parts. I don't know what to do with it, but I'm having a blast.
That's great. I think that's awesome. And it made me start thinking about, you know, Laura was 14 in The Long Winter, or around 14, right?
She turned 14. Yeah.
And I have to wonder if, like, you know, a 14-year-old girl stuck in that snowstorm, you know, like, I have nothing to do. Like, I'm going to lose my mind type of thing. And I have to imagine that a lot of people would turn to something like learning an instrument or art or, you know, doing something to kind of keep your mind moving. And I think that maybe that's something that you did. You know, you thought like, well, you know, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? You know, it was such a questionable period of time. And here you are, you know, at the light at the end of the tunnel, and you now play cello. So I think that's really incredible.
It's something I never expected to do. And I do think, as a lot of people have done, how many times have you heard the pandemic era compared to Little House on the Prairie?
Too many times.
And, yep. And I think in these, you know, super uncertain times, people do kind of turn more introspective to what would I like to do? Look at all the people who picked up bread making and said, quilting and
sourdough and all these kind of things that are old, you know, like things that, you know, people are making their own yogurt and people are making their own kefir drink. You know, people are doing things, gardening, things that, I mean, people always did. But there are so many people doing it now. Like, I actually know a number of people in my community who now quilt, for instance, who never quilted. So I don't think that they would have done it if they weren't, like, bored at home, going on YouTube, coming across that video of somebody quilting and saying, I could do this, or I could try.
Yep. I think you got to find those silver linings for things. And I think... this is one of the things that might come out of the pandemic as mm-hmm. a positive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, this book started before the pandemic, right? Like the research for this.
Yes, in fact, it came out right at the cusp of the pandemic, but I had begun the work several years earlier. And as I often share when I'm doing speaking events, somebody will always ask, how did this all begin? And it began because my month popped up to host my local book club, the Neighborhood Book Club. Mm-hmm. And we had just come off of a long series of some pretty heavy books. And
how many people are in your book club?
Oh, we range from about 6 to 15, depending on who's around at any given time.
I like that idea of like a community book club. We don't have that here.
and it's wonderful people. And we've had a couple of losses during the pandemic since we last met. So if we meet up again, we're going to be a smaller and different group. But when my month came up, it was October, and I thought, oh, we should do something not as heavy as these other books. And we had done a young adult novel before. So I thought, oh, let's, as I joke, lighten the mood. And I picked The Long Winter.
Right. It's a hilarious book about snow.
Yeah. And the women were really...
It is a great book.
And I was thinking more Little House and happy and not really thinking so much about the actual topic. But the group was excited about it. So while they were reading the book and I did a quick reread of it, I knew they would want to know whether the winter was really as bad as it was. And I really didn't know. And there just wasn't a lot out there to give me any quick answers.
See, I grew up thinking that it was really all embellished. And I think that's something that I really learned over the years, but especially in your group, which again, people should join and learn about what was going on in 1880. And that's an 81 during that winter. You just posted, I think yesterday or today, a photograph of a train going through snow that must be, I don't know, 10 feet?
Well, it's taller than the cars.
It must be 15 feet, maybe. It's insane.
Yeah, it is. I am so glad that those photographers went out and took those pictures.
Right.
And at the time, they were doing these for those stereoscopic viewers, where it was, you know, a rectangular card with the two photos and 3D. And they were just all the rage and inexpensive. So even modest homes could have one of these and buy lots of cards. So the photographers around the area knew that this was a good subject matter. So like after that first October storm of the winter, a couple of photographers went out, and I have some pictures from St. James, Minnesota, which was never part of the blockade, but they were like on the east edge of things. And the amount of snow from that one first storm is amazing. Kind of sets the mood for the whole winter.
Now, have you ever tried taking a picture of snow or anything?
Yeah.
It's hard. It's not easy. I mean, you look at these shots, though. I mean, there's high contrast and you can see everything. And I'm thinking, these guys really saw like an issue, I'm sure, at some point, and they really kind of figured a way to still photograph it in a beautiful way.
Yep. And think about how bulky the equipment was.
Yeah. Tripods and everything.
Glass plates. And one of the things I think about is, you know, I've done some drone photography and drone video over some of these areas, but the modern cameras, and even with the drones, there's parameters you have to stay within. The cameras don't like to get cold, or the lenses will fog up, or, you know, there's this, that, and the other thing. And these guys were lugging this big, complicated equipment with chemicals and stuff out into these snowbanks.
It's cold.
And some of them did creative views. There are photos of, like, they'd put the camera down at track level looking up.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to have been complicated and cold. And I wonder how many did turn out versus didn't.
I'm sure there were tons of failures.
Yeah, there had to have been with the cold temperatures. And there's a couple where you can see the photographer's shadow. I love those because it kind of puts the photographer there on top of everything else that's going on. But just like you, you know, you got to, reading The Long Winter, you think this has to be embellished. And there are places where things are.
Sure.
But even in the newspapers, they'll say, you know, 15 feet of snow fell. Well, there might have been a 15-foot drift up against the side of a building. But your mind still goes, that's not possible. And right, then you see these photos that thankfully these guys went out and took that show, oh my goodness,
15 feet of snow.
Right. Look at that. Yeah. And especially a couple of them that I've shared the last couple of days where the sides of the railroad track, the snow is well above the top of the railroad cars as they're passing through these cuts.
It's like a tunnel, right? It's crazy.
Yeah. And that had to do with during construction, you know, the trying to get as far and fast as they could, they would cut out these hills so that the tracks could go through on a flat instead of up and over. And they would make those cuts as narrow as possible so that they were almost tunnels. The problem is they weren't true tunnels. So there was an open top. And the snow, instead of blowing over the top of that hill that now has a cleft through it, the snow would blow into it, swirl around and get trapped. Mm-hmm. It would eventually settle and compress into ice. And that was because those cuts were so narrow. So in the years and decades after the winter, the railroad companies made a very concerted effort to widen those cuts. And during the research phase, I actually went out to the Tracy cut area multiple times after what we felt were big snowstorms so that I could see snow drifted in the cuts. And they've done such a wonderful job of solving the problem that there was nothing to see.
Yeah, it was also, I mean, if you really think about it, it's only about 140 years ago that this,
right,
that the Long Winter happened. And, yep, you know, 140 years, all right, it seems kind of like a long time, but not really. And to kind of solve the problem is really an incredible feat of engineering.
Yep. Although kind of sad, because I really wanted to see it cut all full of snow.
Yeah, I mean, of course, but they didn't photograph that, unfortunately. But so with, I just wanted to say, so with your group, what your group, I think, does is it also it also puts a bit of an interactive aspect to your book. So if you buy the book, all right, you've read it, it's a static thing. But now when you go to your group, it's like expanding on certain things. Like this is the article we're talking about, and you can read it for yourself. And I don't know, I think that it's a really, really useful tool, and you're using it in a proper way to, you know, expand upon your book. So
cool. It's been fun, and thank you for seeing it as that. It's been fun. I wanted people to be able to see, one, reinforce just how crazy that winter was, but to get a flavor from the editors themselves, because each one had a different personality. Each newspaper had a personality. And for people to be able to see all these different things that interconnected, really, the fact that these towns were so brand new. And, you know, think about your community, your local community. Mm-hmm. And let's say you all just moved there in many cases less than 6 months ago, and you might still be building your house, and this big blizzard comes and these problems begin to settle in. And how well do you know your neighbors yet? you know, once the blockades really set in, for instance, and food and fuel started running low, food later in the winter, let's say the community through the telegraph finds out, oh, there's a bunch of food in, let's say, Sleepy Eye. Mm-hmm. And you organize and maybe collect up money from around your neighbors to go and bring back food from Sleepy Eye. If you don't know your neighbors all that well, who do you pick to take the money and go get food and bring it back?
Right, because it's life or death, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if yep. this person just decides to not do it, or if they're not reliable, or who knows, whatever thing.
Right. And you may not know these people well enough to know. I did not hear any issues whatsoever during the winter of anybody absconding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it was one of the things I thought about is how new these towns were. The people were still getting to know each other and how, you know, who could be trusted to lead or who could simply be trusted.
How new were the towns? Were they literally just a few years old?
Well, some of these towns were less than 6 months old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They, like, the Smet really started forming in, you know, you have the Ingalls and the Bose and a handful of other settlers around the Silver Lake camp for that winter before the hard winter. But they really started coming in March and April.
Mm-hmm.
And that first blizzard hit in October. So we're just a few months old. And DeSmet was one of scores of towns just like that.
Wow. I didn't know that. I didn't know how new it was during this time.
Yep. Well, and the region I focus on, you can kind of do a dividing line at about Tracy, give or take a little bit west, of towns that were years or a decade or more old to these towns that were a year or less old. And unfortunately, the newer towns were usually the ones behind the blockade. So they were the ones suffering the worst of the deprivations. And I think about that every time I'm out, and I go out to that area a lot. When I'm out there, I think about that, how they were brand new, very dependent, because kind of the mindset shifted a little bit towards we can rely on our grocer and our lumber yard and the trains for bringing in our provisions, so we can focus on other things. And all of a sudden the trains weren't there, and mm-hmm. maybe they were being relied on. And Laura talks about that a bit in The Long Winter, that the, you know, she has Pa and Ma both talk about what a comfort it is that they're going to be in town for the hard winter, where they know they'll be able to get their provisions. Pa mentions food and fuel. Ma mentions food, I think. And there's just this sense of
They're relying on it. They fully rely on it. Sure.
Yep. So many new families maybe didn't have a successful garden for their first year, or didn't have time, or not as much. And so we've got this perfect storm of a new household, a new farm. Even the merchants themselves are new. Mm. There's, I can't remember if she has it in The Long Winter, but in letters between Laura and Rose, they talk about that even the merchants were putting their capital into building their buildings. They just bought their lots. The paint isn't even dry.
I mean, it's literally, I really didn't realize for some reason that it was only 6 months.
Yeah. And so they thought, well, there's no sense in dumping too much extra capital into stocking the shelves, because a delivery is only a train right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I have to put in the chimes of doom here, the bonk bonk, because the trains become non-existent. And what do they do now?
Well, it's another parallel that maybe we could kind of relate with what we've mm-hmm. been going through for the past few years, where yep. all of a sudden, you know, the only things that are open are like Costco or Walmart yep. or something.
Yep. And the whole supply chain ramifications, mm-hmm. you know, you get a glitch in the giddy up and it just cascades down mm. into all kinds of things, which could be part of why people started gardening. So they had a more secure way of obtaining tomatoes and
sure.
beans. And yeah.
Yeah, it makes, I mean, and it makes sense. And I think it's a step in the right direction, personally. I came across this description of your book. I just wanted to read it. I think that it really kind of sums it up nicely. Mm-hmm. Pulling from nearly 3,000 regional newspaper articles, The Beautiful Snow weaves the historical record around through Wilder's fictionalized account. From the tireless efforts to dig out the railroad blockades, to lavish oyster parties, to carefully spun boosterism, the hard winter comes to life with extraordinary tales of survival, resilience, and defiance that adds a rich context to Wilder's beloved novel. So, I don't know. I really like the way that that just kind of summarizes exactly what you were hoping to do. I think it's a beautiful connection of the book, which is, you know, clearly a fictionalized or dramatized version of what happened, but also connecting the historical accuracies that were there, are mm-hmm. there. Another thing I just wanted to bring up about you is that you're like the hobby lady, I think. So you're also a weather spotter. You're a trained weather spotter for the National Weather Service. So this is another thing that would be a part of your passion, is to follow these storm trends and looking into the historical aspects of these blizzards. How did you get involved in that?
There's a couple of interesting things here. I am a summer person. I don't like to be cold. I don't like to be cold. And so that I spend,
but you live in Minnesota.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of inconsistencies. I'm a complicated person sometimes, Mark. I love the beauty of a good summer storm.
Sure.
The clouds, the energy, they can just be beautiful. Sometimes they're not so beautiful. And since we moved to our current location about 12 years ago, there have been multiple tornadoes that have hit within a quarter mile of our house. Wow. So there are definite aspects of summer storms that are not so lovely. But when I was younger, I was terrified of storms. And if there was a tornado warning anywhere in Minnesota, I was hiding in the basement. And
for good reason, too. They're scary. I mean,
yeah, but Minnesota is a big state. So if there's a tornado warning 200 miles away, yeah, I did not need to be hiding in the basement.
That's true.
And I actually had an experience with a severe storm on the Missouri River. I was on the banks of the Missouri River. I wasn't on the river. That we were camping and my daughter was about 2-3 years old, and this severe storm was rolling in from the west side of the river. We were camping on the east side, and it was, if you've never experienced the South Dakota thunderstorm, it is a thing to behold. And as we could see the storm coming across the river, we were quick trying to dismantle the campsite.
Mm-hmm.
And I set my daughter in the tent for safekeeping while we were getting everything crammed into the car. And the gust front hit the tent with its open door.
Oh, God.
Just as I was able to grab onto the poles, because that gust billowed into the tent and put it airborne with my daughter in it.
Oh my God.
And I was whole, you know, they talk about how you can become superhuman. And I held on to that tent with everything I had. And when that storm passed and we'd survived it, it was like, I don't need to be terrified of these anymore. And I became fascinated with them. But I wanted to be smart about it. And so several times I've gone through the training sessions for to understand when you're looking at a storm, what you're looking at and what are the dangerous spots. And if you're looking at it and you're seeing this, what direction you can expect that to go to. And so, yeah, that's kind of how that all came to be.
It's really amazing that you would, you know, you're really facing your fear.
Yep. And that's kind of where all of that came from, was a terrible fear of storms to understanding it so that I can have a healthy respect for it and not be just completely discombobulated by it like I was as a child.
Now you mentioned your daughter, and I believe her name is Laura, which is odd.
Yeah, she'll never forgive me.
Does she share your passion for history and culture?
Yes, but completely different segments of history and different cultures. She is a lot like me in terms of fascinations and wanting to know as much as there is to know about certain things. But the one era of history she has zero interest in,
19th century,
is this, which I find the fascinating era of history. And yes. So yes and no is the answer to that.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it's also, she does carry that that gene where it's like, I have to learn all about this.
Yes, very much so.
And you know what? She'll teach you some stuff probably.
Oh, she does all the time because she's lived all over the world. And as she moves around, then I get to learn more things.
It's amazing. So what are your thoughts about, you know, taking away the literature aspect of it? What are your thoughts about the TV show Little House on the Prairie?
You know, there was a long time where I didn't admit much to watching the show, but as I've aged, I've kind of went, you know, I'm just going to own this.
right.
And I had discovered the books first, and I enjoyed the TV show for the most part. I see there's at least three different things. There's the books, there's the TV show, and there's the history behind the real people. My biggest passion is the history behind the real people. But I enjoy the books and I enjoy the TV show. I have favorite episodes that I watch every opportunity.
What's your favorite episode? Number one.
Oh goodness. I have three favorite number ones and I can never quite decide. But if I kind of go into, I like Little Girl Lost.
Oh yeah. Great episode.
I like Stone Soup and Christmas at Plum Creek are probably the three that I just can't pass by if I stumble upon them or, if I decide I just really need to watch Little House, I will, I have recordings and I will bring them up.
I recently reviewed, Little Girl Lost.
It was the first one I listened to.
With Pamela Bob.
And, yes.
I don't know if you had the opportunity to check out her, web series, but it's really worth watching. It's very, it's clever. It's fun. And it's, it has a lot of heart in it. And, but yeah, we didn't. It's one of those things where when you watch it to discuss it, you start realizing, wow, Karen Grassley brought so much to that particular episode.
Yes, she did, and sort of like reading the books, as you read them as a child and you catch different things and you do as adult with different experiences and perspectives. I think watching episodes are like that as well. You know, as a child, I had more of the good guy versus villain thing. You know, I just could not deal with Mrs. Olson and Nellie as a child. Mm-hmm. And now Mrs. Olson is up there as one of my favorites because of the way she portrays that character. She's just a delight.
I mean, she definitely has moments where you're like, oh my God. But other times, like, I don't know, I love the character so much. All of Nellie and her, I think that they're kind of a perfect team.
Yep. And I think I needed more maturity behind me to appreciate those characters and the way they're brought up. But what's interesting is I was thinking about this is aside from the Blizzard episode, there's really not anything in the series that can be tied terribly closely to the Long Winter.
Yeah.
And yet think about the dramatic possibilities there could have been. You know, Almanzo could have run off and done something to save the town during a blizzard, but he never did.
Yeah, we would have liked to see that. We would have liked to see him be the hero in an episode. But, you know, I think there's a lot of things that they could have done to the series that could have tied it back into the books a little bit more. But too late now.
Yep. But I enjoy, I'm able to separate those three things to let them all stand on their own without worrying about how they do or don't overlap.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Like, do you have another book in the works? Or, you know, people say they get addicted to writing after they put out their first book.
I do have a manuscript that's close to being ready to go to the editor.
Excellent.
I'm not going to talk too much about what it is. It's related. Mm-hmm. And I just have not had a lot of time in the last 6 months to do anything with it, but I'm hoping to get back to it very, very soon.
That's awesome. And when you do release it, I'd definitely love to have you back to talk about it. Cool. Now, the book, The Beautiful Snow, The Ingles, The Railroads, and The Hard Winter of 1880-1881, can be purchased a number of different places, but the best place probably to go to is thebeautifulsnow.com, where you can get it directly from you. And, I think that is, we talked a little bit about this beforehand. While the book is available pretty much everywhere, including Amazon and everything, when you buy it directly from, from the horse's mouth in a way, There's so much more to it. Like, you're getting it really from the person, from, price point wise, you make more. But at the same time, I just like to support the author directly, personally. That's one of those type of things. You can also pick up the book at home sites throughout the country. But if you just go to thebeautifulsnow.com, you can follow your career as well as purchase the book.
Yeah.
Which I encourage everyone to do.
Thank you.
But Cindy, I want to thank you so much for coming on here and talking about your book and Little House and Storm Chasing.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Anytime. The door is wide open. So if you ever want to come back on and talk about some more stuff, please, keep in touch with me. Thank you for listening to the Little House Book Club. If you enjoy Little House on the Prairie and the history that surrounds it, you might want to take a listen to Wanak Grovecast as well as the Bonnet Heads podcast. All of my podcasts are family friendly and listener supported.
Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight and dance by the light of moon? Buffalo gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight.